We kick things off by welcoming back to the program our friend David Roth of Deadspin. Hello there, David.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
I am so good, thank you. What's going on in your world?
Oh, man, it's I feel you on the whole waving goodbye to February eagerly thing. This has been a very unpleasant month, but we secured a new union contract at work. Everybody is breathing a lot more deeply than we had for 6 months. So, like, actually, I'm enjoying a Friday feeling today. I don't know how long it'll last. Hopefully for the duration of this call.
Well, good. Well, congratulations on all of that. It's not quite as good as a 13-year, $330 million deal, but it's not bad.
Yeah. I thought we'd be the biggest signing of the 24 hours, but apparently people are more interested in the guy that won the MVP award in 23 or whatever, which is fine. There's no accounting for Dave.
Of course, up here, everybody's thoughts immediately turn to Mookie Betts and what will he get? But I wonder about Mike Trout. The only thing I can think that they can do to top this is you got to give him something. I was thinking maybe the state of Rhode Island. It's small, but it's valuable.
Yeah, and Scott, there's some beaches.
Right.
There's a lot of those large houses in Newport. And I think if you make the case to the I think it's probably 800 or 900 people that live in Rhode Island, if you sit down with them directly and say, would you be willing for, just to, Mookie Betts has your house now, but he stays in Boston, I feel like a lot of people would be at least willing to listen.
Oh, yeah. I think that's not a deal breaker. There's no question about it. Let's get to the really important stuff. Not enough people know the story about Brandon Nimmo. I think you need to share that.
So it's a developing story. I'm glad that you care about it. This was something that I did basically. I don't usually have to ask if I can do a blog post at work, but the story of Brandon Nimmo undercooking a piece of chicken, proudly taking a photograph of it, sending it to his wife, and then staying up all night barfing struck me as not just a perfect spring training story, but an extremely New York Mets story. And, I did a little stupid blog on it, and the story is continuing to develop. I did not think that this would be one that would have a second day. But earlier today, Brandon Nimmo's wife tweeted out that, in fact, he had a virus and that he did succeed in cooking the chicken correctly. I have a request for comment in with her because somehow this is what journalism looks like when I do it. And I'm trying to, but I would really like to figure out what actually happened here. He was apparently very unhappy, and the Mets, for a while, we're saying that they're going to teach him to cook, which I think would put him at significantly greater risk than if he had to cook chicken for himself every night. I would not let the Mets, I wouldn't let them teach somebody how to parallel park. I sure wouldn't let them, handle meat.
We're talking with David Roth of Deadspin here on Downtown. Well, this week we learned reason number, for me, about 117 of why I could never live in Florida. Yeah, it's bad enough, the old folks with their chin resting on the steering wheel, but now you got to watch out for billionaires in a hurry to get to the massage parlor. Good Lord, what is wrong with that place?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I wish I had an answer for you there. That one, I feel like there's still a great deal that we don't exactly know about that story, and yet the things that are known and that are not contested except by, Robert Kraft's lawyers very vigorously, are pretty bad. The whole thing just really stinks. And there's this tawdriness to it that I think was, it was clear as it was sort of evolving the night, Thursday night. I watched some of our more able reporters do it while, periodically offering to help copy edit, because that's where I can help on a story like that. It just all felt, it was gross enough that it was clearly a thing, and the NFL was clearly involved. And then as it started to take a more coherent shape, and it seemed like, we just sort of kept hearing Robert Kraft's name linked to it, it still sort of doesn't compute that this is a thing. Not because I have any illusions about what a, respectful or civic-minded man Robert Kraft is. I think he probably is a little bit of both of those things. But just because it's so scuzzy, I think it's the power of Florida, man. Nobody can spend more than 48 hours there without making some miserable life-changing decision.
Well, and as you guys said on the Deadcast, it is both the strangest thing that you would never think of with Bob Kraft, and yet such a uniquely Bob Kraft kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. There are NFL owners that you don't want to admit, although I'm about to do it, to having a list of the NFL owners that seem most likely to get busted in a massage parlor sting. And, like, Robert Kraft is in the top half of that list, but he's not in the top five. It still has this, like, the night that it was happening, we were just watching all of these things, you know, go from red to green. And Drew and I were, you know, both in there not helping at all, being like, no, it's somebody else. It's got to be someone else's mistake. Just because you just don't think of prominent people getting caught. Not that they don't do bad things, but this all just seems so down market and then also so badly done that it still boggles my mind.
And, of course, in that colossal world of dysfunction that is the National Football League, as you pointed out on the podcast, now you've got the scenario where Roger Goodell is forced to punish his boss.
Which should be a really interesting scenario because, for one thing, I mean, at this point, everybody knows that Roger Goodell is a man without any real qualities. I'm sure he's like a nice guy, you know, if you dealt with him personally, maybe. But he has a really hard time successfully punishing athletes for open and shut things the first time around. I don't know that I would, I can't think of anybody that would do a good job disciplining their boss for getting busted in a solicitation sort of scenario. But like Roger Goodell is going to do a really bad job of it. Like, I don't know what it'll be yet. I don't know if it's going to involve some sort of Kraft has to wear a weird hat. It's really hard to imagine how he's going to screw it up, but I'm extremely looking forward to seeing how that takes shape.
Now, I have to ask, I think I know the answer. I'm sure I know the answer. In your mental list of owners likely to be nabbed in this kind of operation, I mean, it's got to be Jerry Jones at number one, right?
It's Jerry, and it's always going to be Jerry. Although, as Drew and I, and Diana to a certain extent, she's a little bit more unforgiving where owners are concerned. Jerry is a nasty man, and I wouldn't want to, you know, if my nephew grew up to be like Jerry Jones, I would feel like I did something wrong. I guess it's a way that I would express it. But he... You know, he inhabits his weird lifestyle so fully that, like, we talked about this earlier, that one of the great revelations in that Mark Leibovich book about the NFL big game is that Jerry basically travels in a giant party bus with stripper poles and just a giant thermos full of Johnny Walker Blue. And that is obviously, you know, I would say that that's conduct unbecoming to a certain extent, but he's not driving the bus. You know,
So
you take your, like, so that, does that make him more responsible than Jim Irsay? Like, maybe, kind of, right?
Oh, sure, it's yeah.
I mean, to know where that all ends.
Right, he's got the bag of pills somewhere on the pleasure van, but he's not behind the wheel.
Yes, yeah, which is, you know, and to a certain extent, I'd say knock yourself out. I think with Jerry, there's some limits, and I can't think of who would ever impose them on him. But
we had Mark Leibovich on the show, and I love the story he told about going on there, going on the van, the bus, whatever it is, and not really remembering how he got out.
Yeah, it's great. It's one of my favorite I mean, I enjoyed the book greatly, but it's one of my favorite bits in it, because not just because it's a great story, but, you know, as somebody who's also had to write similar things, like, I was like, that is as well as you can write, like, I went on this guy's bus and blacked out and fell asleep for 5 hours. Like, it's really hard to report that effectively, you know, like in such a way that doesn't make you look extremely unprofessional. But then when you got through, you know, to the end of the chapter, you're just like, all right, yeah, he really nailed the Jerry Jones experience there by passing out for 5 hours. But he did do it.
All right. I don't want to keep people from listening to the Deadcast because, as always, it's awesome. But I do need to ask about your thesis here that fajitas are a gateway drug.
Well, I think in a good way.
Yes.
I think that this is, you know, the term gateway drug, often because it is applied to, you know, actual drugs, has kind of a negative connotation. And maybe I could have rethought my phrasing there.
No.
But we had a reader write in asking if we thought that fajitas were, you know, are they fraudulent? I'm trying to use radio appropriate language as opposed to podcast language. And I have no problem with fajitas. Some of my happiest moments in restaurants have been sitting there while someone carried fajitas past our table, and you get the waft and the, you know, the audio element of it. It's all really nice. I just think that there's an infinite number of more interesting Mexican or Tex-Mex foods to fajitas. And yet, like, that gets you started on the idea of, like, flour tortillas, putting stuff together yourself. And then the next thing you know, you've moved on to tacos. You're comfortable with the concept. And then maybe you don't need to go back to fajitas anymore.
All right.
I should. It works better if I have a dry erase board.
No, definitely.
It's a complicated point.
I would love to see that. All right. Let's talk about the week in Trump. It's been an interesting one. Of course, the hearings of the Oversight Committee, the failed deal in North Korea, Jared's clearance that apparently nobody approved but the president, and on and on. But nothing to me was more entertaining and bizarre in Trump world this week than the Republicans on that Oversight Committee. And when even the guys on the outside trying to get in, like Matt Gaetz and some of these others, it's like the worst Goodfellas remake ever.
It's incredible. I mean, I think that we'll be lucky if this is the worst effect of the Trump presidency. But there's this way in which, like, I've been thinking about this. I haven't written about it, and forgive me if this comes out incoherent, where I think that there's this, like, ambient Trumpiness that has sort of gripped that party, not just in terms of, like, you know, overt racism and, like, sort of, like, stupid pandering, you know, anti-immigrant stuff, which is obviously all very bad. But these people were all, you know, and not to say that these are towering intellects, you know, Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows, these guys that if they could change a tire in under 3 hours, I'd happily give you a dollar. But the way that they were arguing, it felt like this kind of warmed over attempt to ventriloquize Trump, you know, to, like, sort of do it how he would do it. But if you're not him, you just sound desperate. I mean, he is desperate too, and he does sound desperate. But all of this stuff about, you know, sort of aimless aggression and not really having any idea where your sentence is going to end when you begin it, all that stuff that somehow works, or, like, works in quotes for Trump, that these guys just came off like people that had watched too much television and also maybe had too much coffee. But it didn't, none of it landed, and you can't let Michael Cohen run circles around. Like, he's a doofus. And yet, like, he just roasted these guys. It was really remarkable to see.
So you're saying liar, liar, pants on fire isn't a great way to start a cross-examination of a witness.
I mean, you know, with all due respect to Paul Gosar, he's been through a lot. As you recall, he won his 2018 campaign despite, like, everyone in his family making an ad for his opponent. That was, you know, that's real.
That's,
like,
right.
One of my favorite things that happened. And the fact that he had a visual aid that had the words liar, liar, pants on fire written on it, the fact that he referred to it as an adage, which is really something, it was really, I mean, to me, that is my favorite moment of the entire thing. And yeah, the fact that, like, Paul Gosar never laid a glove on him, despite, you know, he made somebody in his office go to Kinko's and get those words printed on oak tag.
But he doesn't even make my top three, because I where to begin? I mean, Mark Meadows, he's got a black friend, so he can't be a racist. Jim Jordan,
yes.
Who, look, if you want people to forget the wrestling scandal, maybe stop dressing like a wrestling coach. And then my favorite, this guy from Louisiana, the corrupt cop, Clay Higgins, who sounds like Senator.
Incredible.
He's like Beauregard Turdbottom. And my good sir, I defend the honor of the South, my good sir.
He's incredible. He actually, I had forgotten that he was a part of the proceedings. He is one of the most outlandish dudes. And obviously everybody in Louisiana, like, more or less, to the extent they vote for things, is just like, they're trying to pick the funniest guy. And I respect that it's a coherent approach. You know, they have the politics to match, but he is, like, one of those dudes that you see on YouTube that, like, he's just, like, ranting into a dash cam in his car, like, parked in, like, whatever, outside of Shaw's, being like, and another thing about getting divorced, like, and that dude's in Congress.
Yeah, but it's not limited to them.
Remarkable.
Have you seen the ads and the posters for the guy that Harris down in North Carolina has endorsed to take his place on the ballot,
incredible,
in the special election, dressed up like Boss Hogg? You couldn't make this stuff up.
It's unreal. Honestly, it's North Carolina. It's that district. Like, I can't imagine that somebody like that will be in Congress. And yet there's, like, probably maybe five guys that dress like that all the time that are in conference. There's a lot of people there. I can't keep track of all of them. And there is this bizarre race to the bottom. That guy's name is also incredible because it's like Stony Snuggins or something. Like, it's just like a name that you would make up if you saw a picture of that man who's wearing, in the photo we're talking about, all white suit, white vest, white hat, holding a shotgun in one hand and a cigarillo in the other. Like, this is real. That man wants to be in Congress. And yet, like, his name is actually, it's not some, you know, procedurally generated, you know, conservative politician name thing. It's real, the whole thing.
And I think
they
only got him because the guy who played Jackie Gleason's son in Cannonball Run is either dead or unavailable.
It'll be really sad when he loses to Jerry Reed in the election, but you never know. These things change.
David Roth of Deadspin, always a treat, my friend. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your union success, your new contract, and better days ahead as we move into the month of March. We will talk to you again very soon, I hope.
Thanks very much, Ben. I appreciate you having me always. Have a good one.